Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
If you drive around Queens, it looks like a bomb went off.
President Biden comes face to face with fallout from Hurricane Ida. And I talk to the politician who put climate center of the national stage decades ago, former California Governor Jerry Brown. And
on September 5th, 2017, Winnie Duan disappeared without trace from the streets of Beijing.
The unbelievable story of Winnie Duan and where politics and business collide in Xi Jinping's China. Her former husband Desmond Shum joins us with the book he says Beijing does not want you to read. Then, Trump of the tropics doubles down how Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro is sowing doubt on the next election and undermining democracy. Plus,
this is an abuse of the judiciary, and by the way, it's an insult.
Legal correspondent Dahlia Lithwick talks to Michelle Martin about Texas and the Supreme Court reshaping America. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. President Joe Biden has touched down in New York and New Jersey today to see firsthand just how Hurricane Ida caused more mayhem and damage and death there than it did when it actually made landfall in Louisiana days earlier. More than 60 people died in the storm that brought unprecedented rainfall and extreme flooding from the south all the way up to the northeast. President Biden says we are all in a race against the clock.
For decades, scientists have warned of extreme weather would be more extreme, and climate change was here, and we're living through it now. We don't have any more time.
This, as over on the West Coast, the Dixie Fire is on the verge of becoming the largest wildfire in California's history. Nearly one in three Americans live in a county that's been hit by a weather disaster in the last 3 months. That shocking statistic is from a new Washington Post analysis. As more and more people are impacted directly by the consequences of climate change, even the former head of FEMA is asking whether the country is finally headed toward a proper tipping point. And if not now, when will and what will it take? So when he was governor of California, Jerry Brown was one of the first American politicians to really make climate an issue. He now chairs the California China Climate Institute at UC Berkeley, and he's joining me from Williams in the northern part of the state. Governor Brown, welcome back to the program. So let me just ask you to follow up on what the former FEMA administrator said, given that shocking analysis from the Washington Post that so many Americans are now face to face with climate change and its effects. Do you think, you know, as a seasoned politician, that we're on the way to a tipping point that will affect politics in Washington?
No, I wouldn't say we're at a tipping point yet. I foresee arriving at one, but because of the deep dependence on oil, gas, and coal for our whole civilization, for this television program, for our clothes, our cars, our houses. Our whole existence has been dependent and fueled by oil, gas, and coal. And now we're being told, and it's true, we got to get off it. Well, that's going to take heroic effort sustained over decades. So in face of all that, politicians are going to respond to the immediate. They're not going to lose jobs. They're not going to raise taxes. They're not going to embark on anything too bold yet. So I think we're going to have stops and starts. We're going to have failures. We're moving slowly in the right direction. But neither China nor the United States nor the rest of the world has yet grasped the full magnitude of what the world is now facing.
When you lie awake at night, maybe having nightmares about this, what then do you think it will take? You know, the stop-start, decades-long sustained effort that you're talking about, we don't actually have the time for it. What do you think it will take, if anything, for a tipping point to be reached regarding this dependence on fossil fuel?
We are moving in the right direction conceptually. in people's ideas in leadership positions. 8 years ago, there was virtually no coverage on mass media of climate change. Now it's all over with the floods and the hurricanes and the fires in California and in other places in the world. So we're waking up, but it's going to take more, I'm afraid, I'm not advocating, I'm just telling you, it's going to take more disasters, more political deadlock, and more debates, and more rhetoric between the United States and China until finally these big nations and these big leaders start collaborating, cooperating at the level they should. The first test will be in Scotland at the Conference of the Parties. Can China and the United States and Europe and India really do the right thing? Or are we going to have to spend another year waiting to get the message? I think it's very much up in the air. I know President Biden is trying very hard. President Xi has set some ambitious goals, but it's not enough. It's not fast enough. So we're going to have more fires, more floods, more disasters that you'll be able to cover, unfortunately.
So I'm going to get more into China in a moment. But first, I want to ask you, because you talked about leadership and you talked about Washington. So let me just ask you directly. You know, it looked for a while that the president was going to get, you know, the big sort of spending bill, $3.5 billion spending bill, aiming to invest in climate policy and social programs. But just recently, you'll know that Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat from the coal state of West Virginia, has called on the party to take a, quote, strategic pause, and that puts this bill in danger. Now, others are pointing out that he has potentially got a conflict of interest. He has huge amount of stock in private coal brokerage company Energy System, or Ener Systems, that he co-founded and his son still runs. Is that a problem? Is his politics and his base a problem? How worried are you that this senator is now holding up something that looked like it was going to go through?
Oh, look, yes. This is a problem, and if Joe Manchin doesn't vote for the for most of this proposal of Biden, it is a problem, big problem. But we're facing resistance, not just from a Democrat from West Virginia or maybe some other state with a lot of coal. We're facing most, if not all, of the Republican Party wanting Biden to fail and not taking seriously what it takes to curb carbon emissions. And by the way, the Chinese are building huge numbers of coal plants. So to be fair, the world is still sleepy when it comes to the facts. And the truth of the matter is, we have two big assignments. Number one, we have to adapt. We have to build protection from floods. We got to deal with the forests and the fires. We have all sorts of things to do just to protect ourselves from the bad weather that is going to get worse over the next two decades. At the same time, we have to reduce our carbon emissions by going to renewable energy. Both of those will cost trillions of dollars and will demand a level of political insight and courage and agreement that does not exist, as far as I can see, in Washington or Beijing or Moscow or New Delhi or a number of other places where it must be realized in a very, very deep way in order to move forward.
So, Governor, you know, you're obviously very, very, you know, closely connected to the China issue. You've met and sat across the table and negotiated with you know, the Chinese Communist Party leader Xi Jinping himself. And you've probably obviously been looking at some of the, I guess, I don't know what to call it, but sort of bad blood that's going on now between Senator Kerry, Biden's particular climate czar, and his Chinese counterpart. They're trying to negotiate on all this. And the foreign minister said earlier, the U.S. side hopes that climate cooperation can be an oasis in China-U.S. relations. But if that oasis is surrounded by desert, it will also become desertified sooner or later. So obviously they don't like the fact that the U.S. talks to them about human rights, about intellectual property, about all the things that the U.S. has at issue. And so what do you think is going to come out of the negotiations with China? It doesn't look very good right now.
No, it doesn't look good, but the Chinese and American leaders, they're smart, they know what the world is, and China and the U.S. must cooperate, or they're headed to a disastrous conflict of various kind, many conflicts, and maybe the ultimate conflict. So I think they're going to pull back. One problem I see, China's doing a lot of stuff we don't like, but I don't see how you can have a dialogue, a negotiation, where the U.S. side always says, look, me good, you bad. You got that, China? Until you accept all your bad and all our good, we're not going to get anywhere. I think we need a touch, maybe more than a touch, of humility. We didn't look so good, or we're not so good, in fact, terrible, in Afghanistan, the Iraq War, all sorts of things. Now, I'm not saying, I don't want to pick America better, China worse. We got to realize we're on one earth, we have one climate. We are emitting heat-trapping gases that are going to destroy millions of people. We got to get off these lesser issues, however big and important they seem. We have to find a way in what I call planetary realism. We both inherit this Earth. And I would invoke John Kennedy at his American University speech in June of 1963, where he said to the Russians, the Soviets, we inherit the same planet, breathe the same air. We want our grandchildren to have a life. We're both mortal. That's the way we got to talk to China and find common pathways. Today, I would say there is a disinclination for that. And most of the politics in Washington are highly aggressive and, I would say, counterproductive.
So I just want to pursue a couple of points there because, you know, me good, you bad. You've pointed out, and others, that China is committed to more coal-fired plants, and that's going to be a problem. Yes. But at the same time, to bolster your point, the Biden administration has just, announced plans to open up millions of acres for oil and gas exploration. And that's, of course, complying with a court order that required the administration to resume these lease things. So it's clearly a point of huge criticism in the climate and environmental community. But it means, doesn't it, as you say, that the U.S. doesn't have a huge leg to stand on when it's trying to persuade China or India?
No, look, California itself is burning 18 billion gallons of diesel and gasoline every year. Our cars drive 250 billion miles a year. We got a lot to account for and a lot to change, as does China. I think China and the U.S. need each other to push each other in the right path, because we have enormous resistance, and I think the coal interests within the Communist Party, within China, are also as powerful as the oil and gas interests are in Texas and in the rest of America. So look, the world needs a turn by America and by China. We have, look, in World War II, I remember, and you certainly do, the pictures of Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin. Stalin was doing many more horrible things than China's doing today. But the common enemy brought them together. We have a common threat called a deteriorating climate. And because we have a common threat, we have a common interest. Common vulnerability translates into common interest if you just open your eyes. So that's where I derive some optimism that whatever the pulling and shoving is now, we are going to draw closer. But how long it takes and how many casualties along the way, that remains to be seen.
So let me ask you then on this, because clearly you had brought up earlier that all this effort to distance oneself from dependence on fossil fuels will cost money, etc. But all the experts and you yourself, I'm sure, know that it'll cost a huge amount more money not to do anything about it and try to do cleanup later. Your state, the fifth biggest economy in the world, especially under your leadership, spent a lot of time thinking about these big issues. You went and spoke specifically to Xi Jinping, and you've put climate well front and center. Your successor, Gavin Newsom, the governor, has also done the same, and he's now facing a recall, and you have said he mustn't be for the sake of the planet and climate. Do you think he'll be recalled? And if he is,
no.
How negative is that for your issue?
Oh, it'd be very negative. I don't think Gavin Newsom will be recalled. He's putting on a good campaign, And the politics of California, whatever criticism may be lodged against the governor, there's basic widespread support that will enable him to defeat this very misguided idea that you got to have a recall a year before the regular election. So I think the people are not going to buy it in California.
Can I just broaden a little bit? I'm sure you've been following, you know, the issues of the Supreme Court and whether it's about voting, whether it's about women's rights, the issue of the Texas state test case banning a woman's right to choose and empowering, according to some experts, a sense of new vigilantism on the street, going after anybody who may be involved in any such procedure in Texas. Let me read you what John Michaels and David Knoll, two professors from UCLA and Rutgers, have said. Up until now, the law usually conferred rights on people who were seeking to exercise personal autonomy over their bodies, their words, or their votes. This new breed of private enforcement laws inverts that paradigm, giving rights to people who are merely offended by what they see, hear, or imagine. Where do you see this leading in terms of empowering people's private action, not only in Texas, but potentially elsewhere, not only on this issue, but potentially others?
Look, what this is, the Texas law is a bounty hunter provision. It gives $10,000 reward for anybody who can file a lawsuit and be successful against not only a doctor who performs an abortion, but anybody who gives a ride or helps in any way to bring the woman to the abortion clinic. This is exploiting the polarization and the deep feelings of millions of Americans. It's not the way to go. We are a divided society in a very dangerous world. We have to find higher unities. And to empower random disconnected individuals to jump into lawsuits against people who are trying to help a woman follow her conscience and what she wants to do. It's crazy. It's politically divisive. And I think it's going to galvanize the political opposition and redound to the benefit of more sensible thinking, not this very narrow view that has been endorsed, at least at the first stage, by five members of the U.S. Supreme Court. Even the chief, Roberts, dissented. So I think there's more to be had. And this, like in politics, you often see, you don't change till you overreach. This is clearly an overreach, and I would suspect the change will be very quickly in coming.
Governor Jerry Brown, great to get your perspective, obviously, on that, but also on the climate challenges and the challenges with China ahead. And we're going to turn now to covering more of China and the fascinating and unsettling story of a woman's disappearance there 4 years ago. Whitney Duan and her then husband, Desmond Shum, were rising stars in China's business world. But after Shum left the country, Duan disappeared without a trace. Nobody had heard a word from her for years, that is, until Saturday. According to Shum, she called him and pleaded that he not publish his new book, one that promises to pull back the curtain on Xi Jinping's China. The call was too late, of course. The book had already been printed. It's titled Red Roulette. And Desmond Shum is joining me now for his first television interview. He's in Oxford, England. Desmond Shum, welcome to the program. Now, this call you got over the weekend must have been very, very unsettling, particularly as you were getting ready to do the publicity for your book's publication. What do you think was the crux of the issue? Why suddenly did your former wife, after 4 years, appear out of nowhere?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I think what happened was on Friday, two major newspapers, Financial Times and Wall Street Journal, both have carried story of my upcoming book and my situation. I think that really changed the dynamics and then prompted the CCP actually allow her to come out. It happened just the day after the two newspaper broke the stories.
So what was her message to you? She didn't just call to say hi. The CCP weren't apparently thrilled that, you know, her former husband is about to publish a book that he says is very revealing in a way they might not like.
She used, it's very difficult. I mean, she want me to, first of all, she want me to cancel the book, the book publishing. Of course, as you were just mentioning, you know, bureaucrats in Beijing probably think at the snap of a finger, any book can pull from any bookstores anytime. Of course, in our world, the book is already in the bookstores by then. So, and also it's difficult for me because I don't know, I don't know who I'm talking to, because for sure her phone is monitored, if not somebody's sitting across from her. And am I talking to her, or am I talking to the party stay behind, listening in, asking me to cancel the book and issuing all the threats?
Mm-hmm. So the threats are what, I guess, interest me and interest many people, and clearly must worry you, your son, and your former wife. Did you feel that she was being used to threaten you? Did she say that there would be consequences for you, her, for your son, if this book went ahead?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I do feel like she is being a mouthpiece of the party state threatening me. The, you know, message where she asked the question, what would happen to our son if something happened to you? She asked the question, what would happen? How will you feel if something happened to your, to our son? And then on the second course, you actually say, if you go ahead with this book launch, it may cost a life.
It's chilling. Yes. And so I guess the question has to be, from those of us listening to you, what is so important about your commitment to the story that you want to get out? Red Roulette is the name of your book, that you are prepared, despite, you know, these clear threats, to keep, what is the story you want the world to know?
I think the world knows too little. Well, first of all, why do I want to go ahead and publish this book? Because I want two things that prompt me to publish it. I first started the book not with planning to publish. I start on the book because the mom of my son has been disappeared. And then a year after, which is 4 years ago, almost to the date. So I start writing the book, say, well, I want to leave something for my son, telling him who we are, what we've done. And then I believe where there's nothing to be ashamed of what we have done in China. What really prompted me to go ahead and publish the book is because as time goes on, you know, she'll disappear for, you know, it was New Year's around, and then say, well, would they let her come out by New Year's? And then it was 6 months. Then say, well, maybe they were, it's 6 months already. Maybe they're going to let her out. And a year gone by, 2 years gone by, I got just really angry. I was like, you control the courts. You control the judge. You can charge her with anything in China and you will stick. And you decide to throw a woman into a dark cell. And just, I just really, you know, I say, I need to come out and tell the story of what China is really, who really owns China, how things really works in there. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, I grew up in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is very, very important and hold dear to me. I have friends, relatives from Hong Kong. And seeing what CCP done to Hong Kong really breaks my heart. I flew back from UK just to be in the protest. And then I flew back another time just to put my vote on a local election.
Okay, so let me just pursue one of these threads. You know, clearly what the main thrust of your book is about is the changing view at the top of the Communist Party in China towards business, private business, and people like yourself, entrepreneurs, after, you know, having a free reign for many years, starting in the, I guess, the late 70s under Deng Xiaoping, which opened up the economy to much more capitalist enterprises and created billionaires. Xi Jinping is now cracking down. They've changed their view of how good or bad you are for the country. And he's now saying, the president, that he wants a whole new kind of economy to sort of close the inequality gap that has that has exploded. So is that what you feel, that, like, you know, just too much money is too dangerous, and that's what you're trying to expose?
No, not at all. Actually, first of all, the book chronicles my life over the, you know, my life. I'm 50 something now. And then my career actually mirrored the rise of China. So I want to, you know, through my personal history, I want to tell what happened, how things happened in China. That's the first part. And the second part is not from Xi Jinping. Actually, by after China really changed after the financial crisis in 2008, that really changed China. The leadership thinks, you know, look at the West. You know, before that, everybody believed, the entire leadership, and I think most of the people in China believe we want to be like the West. We want democracy. We will have more election. We will more have press freedom and all of that. It's the question, the argument around in the society and in the, within the leadership is at what pace are we going to go and get there? That was the debate. After 08, everything changed. They feel like, well, look at the West. The model is not that great. Hey, look at us. If we haven't stand strong, the whole Asia will crash around us. It's because of us. Maybe our model is not that bad. So after the OA, everything changed, many things changed. The state encroached forward, the private enterprise pushed backward, freedom of all sort is being pulled back. And you know, just in my case, you know, party apparatus all of a sudden come up and get set up in my company. I need to answer to the party secretary, which doesn't exist before. So Xi Jinping is just quickens the pace of the change, but it start before that. And the reason is that it's there, and what I was trying to illustrate through the whole my 30 years of business life in China, is the structure is there. Without changing the structure, all the other change is cosmetic. Closing the wealth and the poor, the gap, the disparity, yes, it's right. I agree with it. But the reason they're closing it, it's not because they believe that's more fairness to it. The reason they're closing it is because that's good for the longevity of the rule of the party. The party will have better grip of power because by closing those gaps.
You know, we reached out quite a lot. We tried to get the Chinese government response to your, you know, to the book, because they're clearly, you know, as you've witnessed yourself, they're not thrilled with the fact that you've published it. So the embassy here in the UK told us that the groundless accusations and wanton slanders against Chinese leaders and system by Desmond Shum in his book, Red Roulette, are complete lies. And clearly they didn't want us to interview you either, just like they probably don't want this book to see the light of day. But what do you say to the fact that, in fact, you've written about it and you've talked about it, that they are having a sort of a review, and you've sort of talked about it just now, of their relationship with the business community. And you've also said that when it comes to these matters, and I'm going to quote you because it's quite interesting, you told the Financial Times about the president, you can rely on Xi to make the worst possible policy decision at every turn. If you want to guess where he's going to go next, pick the worst option, he's going to go there. It made me sit up, because I think most people's view around the world of Xi is that he's, you know, maybe a control freak and you know, wants to husband all the political power and et cetera, but that he has a grand strategic vision for the rise of China compared to the rest of the world. You're kind of saying no.
Yes. To your question, there's two things I want to say. Is first of all, I'm not making accusation in book. That's actually what I exactly trying to avoid, because what I'm trying to do is I tell my story. I tell what happened around me, how I do certain things, how do I interact with certain people. I don't make any, you know, accusation to say, oh, CCP is evil. I don't make any. I will let the readers decide for themselves, seeing the story, seeing what is happening. So that's the first thing. So I'm not making accusation. The second thing is, if there's a certain several incidents, You look at the current situation with the U.S., from all my knowledge with different contact within, also within, you know, within the think tank community, within the business community, even with the government within the U.S., I don't believe Trump will start this whole thing with like to get the relationship of U.S. to China to where it is today. It is because how China started as behave in the last few years, you know, including many of you have witnessed this wolf diplomacy, right? I mean, the China's relationship is probably at one of the lowest point with the rest of the world. How does that happen? It doesn't happen with the world say, well, all of a sudden say we want to turn on China. It's all this behavior, right? They have fighter jets flying daily assaults over Taiwan airspace. So all this, and then they look at Hong Kong. Where Hong Kong is, he doesn't have to push that at that pace and that hard to turn Hong Kong to be a subservient society. And then that is destroying Hong Kong. Mm. So I think improving, you know, what he's doing with the tech sector. So in all these incidents, you know, the tech sector destroy, you know, by many counts about $2 trillion. Where that's Chinese capital.
Look, it's really fascinating, and the book is clearly really an interesting read. Desmond Shum, author of Red Roulette, thank you so much. And now we move to Latin America, where its biggest democracy is being tested as well. In Brazil, thousands are on the streets now, marking this year's Independence Day with demonstrations for and against President Jair Bolsonaro. The country appears increasingly divided ahead of next year's election. Right-wing supporters of Bolsonaro clashed with police as they tried to force their way towards Congress. Sound familiar? Critics of Bolsonaro fear that he is increasingly turning to former U.S. President Donald Trump's playbook for inspiration, sowing doubt in the country's democratic institutions. Correspondent Issa Suarez has more on this.
Splashed across a big screen, Brazil's conservatives look to the American right for inspiration.
Do you go the path of socialism, or do you remain steadfast and strong for freedom?
The Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, an American import, is hoping to revive Jair Bolsonaro's dwindling base. As the embattled president faces sliding approval ratings, a weakening economy, and public outrage over his handling of the pandemic, which has claimed over 580,000 lives. Luiz Felipe de Orleans e Bragança, a lawmaker and Bolsonaro supporter, tells us why the president is seeking a second term in office.
He believes that there is a risk that the radical left will take over Brazil and that there is a risk of totalitarian regime to take place in Brazil. And I believe in that too.
With an election in Brazil looming large, this relationship with the Trump inner circle has strengthened over the years, earning the Bolsonaro family the likes of former Trump campaign manager Steve Bannon.
He's the third son of the Trump of the tropics, President Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil. They say, Eduardo, you were...
With Eduardo Bolsonaro making an appearance at the MyPillow CEO's event.
Bolsonaro will win unless it's stolen by guess what? The machines.
The machines.
Taking his cue from the Trump playbook, Bolsonaro has been sowing doubt on the integrity of Brazil's entire electronic voting system, calling for printed ballots to supplement electronically cast votes.
Ah, não tem prova de fraude. Também não tem, porque não há.
And threatening not to hand over the presidency next year if there's suspicion of fraud.
Eu tenho três alternativas para o meu futuro. Estar preso, ser morto, ou a vitória.
As the calls for his impeachment grow louder, Bolsonaro continues to fight for political survival, using the armed forces to project power, with a military parade recently in front of the presidential palace. enough to rattle some of Brazil's political dissidents.
Esse é um gesto de autoritarismo, é um gesto de ditadura. Então, isto me deixa muito preocupada, sim, muito preocupada.
A former member of Brazil's Communist Party, Amelinha Tell, says she was a victim of torture during the country's brutal military dictatorship, which lasted 21 years.
Eu me vi acuada, eu me vi torturada, perseguida, ameaçada constantemente, eu e minha família. Mas nós tivemos também a alegria de ver a resistência e a luta do povo nas ruas.
Is Brazil's democracy at risk, Amelinha?
Com certeza, infelizmente. Nós não podemos largar o passado, achar que o que passou, passou e acabou. Não é verdade. O passado está muito no presente.
Cautionary words from those who carry the scars of those dark days and who fear that Brazil's past might just be about to repeat itself.
Issa Suarez reporting there. And we look to women's rights in the United States next, where the Justice Department vows to protect Texas clinics from prosecution for providing abortions, upping the ante after the state brought in a new law attempting to gut Roe versus Wade. Slate's senior editor and legal correspondent Dahlia Lithwick has been following the Texas case closely, and she tells Michelle Martin what the latest developments mean for women in Texas and beyond.
Thanks, Christia. Dahlia Lithwick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
As we are speaking now, a lot has been written and said about this Texas bill, but I did want to ask, for the sake of those who have not followed it closely, just walk us through it. I think many people will have heard about the so-called fetal heartbeat provision, which makes abortion illegal when cardiac activity is detected. That's usually around 6 weeks. You wrote a scathing piece about this law. You called it an unconstitutional and brutal piece of lawless vigilantism.
I did. I wrote that. I think it's really important to understand that even Texas knows that the current abortion doctrine says that you cannot put an undue burden on a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy until viability. That marker is somewhere between 22 and 24 weeks at present. So when you pass a six-week ban, and the state of Texas knew this was unconstitutional, by the way, this is going to be litigated at the Supreme Court properly, presumably this term, a 15-week Mississippi ban. This is the state of Texas knowingly saying, we're going to do something unconstitutional. 6 weeks is 2 weeks after the last missed menstrual period. Most women do not know they're pregnant that early. And what this means, Texas providers tell us, is that about 85 to 90% of the abortions they usually provide have to be stopped. So to knowingly pass an unconstitutional law and to have a kind of bounty system whereby people are rewarded for suing providers, knowing it's unconstitutional feels lawless.
So tell me a little bit about the Supreme Court's role in this. You were equally scathing about the Supreme Court's behavior in this case. Tell me about that.
Probably the single most important thing that seems really hyper-technical, but it's urgently important, Michelle, is that this happened on the so-called shadow docket at the Supreme Court. So there is a regular docket. It's the thing that I usually cover as a Supreme Court reporter. The court, starting the first Monday in October, hears cases that come up through, they percolate through the lower courts. An appeals court will rule. There's a trial record. There's an oral argument. There's briefing. All of those things happen in regular order. The court also has an emergency docket, right? And this is where a lot of death penalty cases come up. This is when there isn't time to let it percolate through the courts. The urgently important thing is that in the last few years, the court has started using the so-called shadow docket, not just for emergencies, but for voting rights cases, for death penalty cases. We saw a whole bunch of it around COVID orders, shutdown orders, where people said, we don't have time to argue this case and let it work through the system because we're being forced to stop praying now. And the court has overwhelmingly used the shadow docket in recent years to reward, for instance, Donald Trump, some of Donald Trump's laws, and said, oh, this is exigent. We have to do something right now. Just a few weeks ago, the court did away with the eviction moratorium on the shadow docket. So they did this on the shadow docket at midnight, in the dark of night, without briefing, without lower court argument, without an appeals court record. And that's the really pernicious thing here. There is a regular procedure at the court that is open and transparent. Here we had a less than two pages, a page and a half, one paragraph of analysis from the Supreme Court, essentially saying, we don't think anybody has standing to sue. We don't think anybody can win. So good luck, Texas. And to do that late at night in one paragraph, even Chief Justice John Roberts, who voted with the three liberals dissenting in this case, was horrified at the ways in which something so radical, so unconstitutional could be passed in the dark of night without reasoning, without rationale.
Given that the providers are the ones who went to the Supreme Court asking for this emergency injunction, in this case, to stop the Texas law, what's your chief objection to their using the so-called shadow docket for this purpose?
I think that the problem is that it gives the Supreme Court perfect discretion to determine what an emergency is. And really the problem is, if you're going to decide all these things on the basis of people running to the court in the middle of the night and saying this is an emergency, then to say it is an emergency that landlords are facing the continuation of the eviction moratorium, that landlords are in peril of exigent harm, but that women in Texas who will not be able to have a legal abortion effective midnight tonight, or in this case, midnight last night, that's not an emergency, or that people in California who want to pray in COVID and they don't like the ceilings that have been placed on houses of worship, the Supreme Court determined that they had emergency religious freedom rights that were being violated. So I think the principal objection of the shadow docket for me is not just that these cases are not fully ventilated, there's no record, we don't know what actually is happening or what the harms are, but that the Supreme Court is taking it upon itself to decide who is a sympathetic emergency plaintiff. And in this case, they said, oh yeah, those folks who wanted to pray in California and their church was being given less deference than a bike shop or Costco, they had an exigent personal dignitary emergency that we have to act on now. The women in Texas, who by every single metric have a right to end a pregnancy until viability at 22 weeks, they're having the line moved to 6 weeks and they face no exigent emergency. That's the Supreme Court arrogating to itself the power to decide what an emergency is and who a sympathetic plaintiff is. And that has to be wrong.
Well, you have said repeatedly in your writings, and you said here, that this law is unconstitutional. What makes it unconstitutional? I mean, I think the defenders of it say it's constitutional if the court says that it is. So
right.
What makes it constitutional in your analysis?
In fairness, the court here in its 1.5 page order doesn't weigh in on the merits of the constitutionality. And in fact, the unsigned order goes to pains to say we're not making a decision or a declaration about the constitutionality of this. We're just making a decision about whether this is an emergency and whether the court has jurisdiction to grant relief. So you're quite right. It is up to the court at some point to be the arbiter of what is constitutional. But if the court cares about mm-hmm. precedent and stare decisis and the notion that when they say a law is the law, then Roe v. Wade is still good law and Casey is still good law. And any pre-viability abortion ban, any ban pre 22 to 24 weeks, is per se unconstitutional. As I said, the court has a chance to look at that again in this Mississippi case, Dobbs, that's on the docket for this term. If they want to end Roe v. Wade by, you know, actually assessing the law and making a constitutional determination, they can and will likely do that. The question is whether this was the vehicle to start to chip away at Roe.
Conservatives have made three arguments, basically. I'm going to put them in basically three buckets. The first is that people who are criticizing this bill are pro-abortion zealots. So therefore, it's really a matter of whether you agree with access to abortion or not. The second argument is that abortion is bad, so it doesn't matter. In essence, the means are irrelevant to defend the goal, right? If the goal of eliminating abortion or discouraging it severely is so important that it doesn't really matter. But I want to focus on what I've observed is a sort of a legal argument made by conservative legal writers. Their argument is that Roe v. Wade was a garbage decision. It created a right that does not exist. So this might be an equally tortuous garbage decision, but so what? That the two cancel each other out. You've seen that, right? So what is your response to that?
I think my response to all three buckets of arguments is that you could say all of the same things about guns, right? You could certainly say that the kinds of gun cases that are being pressed, again, that will be heard this term at the Supreme Court, are being made by pro-gun zealots. You can say that it doesn't matter what the law is, guns are bad, that, you know, having semi-automatic weapons in the hands of everybody who wants one in a Walmart is bad, and that the Heller, the decision that said that there is a personal, individual Second Amendment right to bear arms to defend yourself is a garbage decision. You can say all those things about anything that you don't like. The problem is it a little bit depends on whose ox is being gored. You can certainly do what the opponents have done and say, it's just bad law and the Supreme Court has the ability to just reverse it. But I think the answer to that is one, stare decisis, right or wrong. And furthermore, I think I would say that the idea that Roe is a garbage decision when it is in fact the cornerstone of so many privacy, dignity protections that came after is a really worrisome road to go down. If you are going to do away with Roe, you're also doing away with what? Griswold, the right to have to use birth control within a marriage. So I think it's very, very dangerous to say that precedent doesn't matter, because what that argument leads to, and this is for me the chilling thing, is pure power. What you're saying is the law is what five people say the law is, regardless of centuries of precedent. And that really isn't a legal argument. That's a pure power argument.
I'm wondering if there's a way in which this could have been anticipated. I mean, do you think the administration and the pro-choice advocacy community were caught flat-footed here? And if so, why?
I think one piece of it that is really startling that we haven't reckoned with yet is the ways in which this is of a piece with a whole bunch of laws that are conscripting citizen vigilantes into taking the law into their own hand. We're seeing it in the voting context, right? That you can take it upon yourselves to enforce voting rights. We're seeing in the COVID context. And I think that the sense that citizens should give up on law enforcement and take the law into their own hands and do what they will is really new and really frightening. To the second part, I think the reason if folks were caught flat-footed, if they were surprised by what happened in Texas, I think it's because they weren't paying attention to what was happening in Texas. If you were a provider on the ground in Texas, you already witnessed HB2. That was the attempt to close clinics in 2013 that the Supreme Court reversed in Whole Women's Health. You saw Governor Abbott, try to shut down abortion clinics during COVID, saying it was unessential health services. So I think part of the play here, and it's very worrisome, is that it's easy to say Roe is still good law, Casey is good law. It was reaffirmed again 2 years ago in the Supreme Court. So we're all safe. But if you are in a state like Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, where there's one clinic left, where there are waiting periods, where there are endless hoops to go through, this isn't a surprise at all.
What I'm curious about is why the court was not more interested in the abuse of the judicial system for this, because the court does and has in the past been concerned about the abuse of the legal system. I was just wondering, what is your thought about that?
I think the short answer is we don't know, because the decision was so abrupt that we have no idea what was going through the minds. As I said, the page and a half of reasoning was unsigned. We don't even know who wrote it, much less what they were thinking. And I think the cynic in me says that's because it has the effect that they wanted, which is abortions have stopped. And it doesn't matter kind of the principles. The deeper principle here, and it's the one that John Roberts flicks at in his dissent, is not just abuse of the judicial system, but abuse of the Supreme Court itself, a deliberate defiance of Supreme Court precedent, and a kind of underappreciated, completely overruling of Roe by a state. And that offends John Roberts, who thinks deeply about the role of the judicial branch and the need for the sort of dignity and esteem, the public regard of the judicial branch. I don't think John Roberts has any problem with ending Roe v. Wade. He's clearly on the record wanting to do away with abortion rights. I think the reason he votes with the dissenters is exactly what you're pointing to, which is this is an abuse of the judiciary. And by the way, it's an insult to the judiciary. And that's the thing, I think, that forces Roberts to peel off and vote with the liberals in dissent.
I just don't think it's a secret that this has been a 30-year project of the conservative movement. I mean, it's been a generation-long project of the conservative movement to dominate the judiciary. That is a fact. And it's also a structural issue now, because it's also been a 30-year project of the conservative movement to dominate state legislatures, which has been achieved. So given that there's a structural imbalance here, what do people who disagree with this do now?
Well, I think in the very near term, they do everything they can to help women, particularly poor women and women of color in Texas. And that may include helping construct funds to help them get out of state. We've seen a huge uptick in women already traveling to New Mexico and to Oklahoma. But you're quite right. That doesn't solve the larger structural problem. And those are the places where I think you're also right. A lot of people have just taken their eye off the ball. If you look at polling around reproductive rights, the country is absolutely emphatically clear that none of what we're seeing in Texas aligns with what the majority say in polls. The vast majority of Americans support abortion. And so I think what has happened...
They support abortion in some context, just to be clear about that. I think it is accurate to say they don't support all access to all abortion at all times. But I think it is accurate to say that a majority of the country does support access to abortion under most circumstances, at most times. The legal consensus that currently exists is generally supported by the public.
That's a really good clarification. That's exactly right. I think what the term of art is abortion on demand. And you're quite right that we don't have vast majorities supporting all abortion all the time. But I will say that a law like the Texas law that has no exceptions for rape and incest is really, really reflective of a very, very minority opinion. And I think that the reason that we're seeing these quote unquote heartbeat bills, right? We've seen in 2021 alone, record numbers of anti-abortion laws passing in state houses in red states is exactly because of what you've said, because of a capture of state legislatures and also because of a capture of the courts. And I think that that requires systems thinking, not sort of individual liberty inchoate, you know, frustration, but thinking about systems, thinking about how it is that, by the way, Texas, the same day that that SB 8 went into effect, passed this massive restrictive voting law. So how is it possible that we are looking at minority positions being written into law? And so I think that if this is the kind of thing that worries people, it really is time to start thinking about structural court reform of the federal court, something that nobody wants to say out loud. It's time to start thinking about winning state houses. It's time to think very, very seriously about whether, you know, free and fair elections can happen if massive numbers of voters are suppressed. And I think those are the kinds of things that are really boring and they're really technical and they don't make for good television. And so nobody really wants to think in terms of those systems. But you're quite right. Those systems are exactly what is kind of coming home to roost now.
Dahlia Lithwick, thank you so much for talking with us today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Fascinating, really, and important. And finally tonight, an extraordinary tale of survival. It happened in Australia, where a three-year-old boy has been reunited with his family after going missing in a rural area. Anthony A.J. El-Falak was located on a riverbank less than 500 meters from his family home after an intense search and rescue. The toddler, who has autism and is nonverbal, miraculously managed to survive in the bush for 3 whole days. He was found cupping water in his hands in order to drink, which police say, of course, was key to his survival. What a clever boy with such a strong survival instinct, who is now safe and recovering with his parents. And on that great and happy news, that is it for now. And you can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.